Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. So as you guys know, The Realignment is sponsored and hosted by Lincoln Network. Not the Lincoln Project, mind you, but the Lincoln Network. So in order to let everyone know a little more about Lincoln's work and their upcoming Reboot 2020 conference on November 6th, 9th, and 10th, Sagar and I are dedicating some time on Fridays for bonus episodes of The Realignment that are really focused on the tech industry and the way that Silicon Valley and tech policy in Washington, D.C. are changing during the year 2020. So last week, we spoke with Jared Dicker about the future of media. Jared works at The Washington Post. Definitely go back and listen to that if you haven't got the chance. But this week, we are focused on an interview with Reeves Weideman, who is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. He's recently written Billion Dollar Loser, The Epic Rise and Spectacular Fall of Adam Neumann and WeWork. So I wanted to talk with Reeves because what's so interesting about his book is that it's not just the very interesting tale of how Adam Neumann of WeWork fame did all these different crazy things, but it's also a really great sort of articulation of a specific point in time in the technology industry, really that post-recession 2008 period to 2019 when WeWork's IPO blew up. So during this conversation with Reeves about the book, we talk about the idea of software eating the world. We talk about how the tech industry looked in the 2010s and how it's going to look in the 2020s. And interestingly, because this relates to WeWork, we really talked about what the future of work, offices, and cities are. So there's a lot of really great stuff here. So just a reminder, if you find this conversation or last week's conversation interesting, go to rebootconference.org to learn more about Lincoln Network's Reboot 2020 conference. Sagar is going to be there. I'm going to be there. Lots of really great conversations, November 6th, 9th, and 10th. See you there. Reeves Weideman, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
So Reeves, you've just authored Billion Dollar Loser, The Epic Rise and Spectacular Fall of Adam Neumann and WeWork. But you also did some really great reporting about WeWork's sort of pre-IPO space at New York Magazine. So for the sake of anyone who didn't follow the sort of WeWork kerfuffle, which is to put it lightly, can you sum up the company, who Adam Neumann was slash is, and sort of the course of events that sort of led to the space right now?
Sure. So, you know, WeWork was a company founded by Adam Neumann and his partner, Miguel McKelvey, in 2010. This was sort of in the end of the last recession, the financial crisis. And they started this basically what we now would think of as a co-working company, but it was essentially a business of taking up commercial real estate and cutting it up and adding in beer kegs and nice coffee and good design and renting it out to people. And for years, the business grew pretty extraordinary way. It doubled in revenue every year, expanded for basically a decade, expanded all over the world. And by the time I started writing about the company, in the beginning of 2019, it had a $47 billion valuation. And the reason we were interested in the company at New York Magazine was that our office in Soho in Manhattan was suddenly surrounded by half a dozen WeWorks. And so it felt to us like, let's just try to understand kind of how this company is seemingly growing as fast as it is and where it's going. And it very quickly became clear to us that the core to this story, both in the rise and some of the problems that were already starting to emerge then in the spring of 2019, were centered around Adam Neumann, the founder of the company. And it was only from the time we published that story in June of 2019, it was only, I guess, 3 or 4 months between then and the company attempting to go public, and having that effort flame out in pretty spectacular fashion last fall, and resulting with Adam being pushed out of the company. So
the most obvious sort of question here is, aside from the various Adam anecdotes, which I think there's a million of those, but the books are told. It's a narrative book. So I suggest everyone who purchases it, just read through that part. And we could obviously get into it here. But I think the first question would be, why did this story sort of matter? Because obviously there's plenty of founders, and Adam was sort of the 10X version of this, but there are plenty of founders who have sort of idiosyncratic personalities. There are plenty of companies that spend a lot of money and don't make a profit and either flame out. Why for you does this story matter?
I think we saw it as kind of the most extreme version of a lot of what you just talked about, and a lot of the ways that the startup world seemed to operate in the 2010s. This was an era of you know, pretty incredible economic growth and pretty incredible opportunities for startups, where money was easy to raise. The impulse for many of these companies was to just kind of grow as big and as fast as you possibly could. And WeWork in some ways was kind of the apotheosis of that. It was a company that spent money more profligately than pretty much anyone else, eventually losing $2 billion the year before its IPO. And so I think we wanted to kind of understand sort of how that ecosystem had developed, and in both in the WeWork story and in the way that it would kind of that it worked with all these other companies that were rising at the same time.
Yeah, so let's talk about sort of the funding model, because when you're thinking about this idea, which is that WeWork and many of these sort of venture-backed companies don't actually make a lot of money, I think if you're sort of a person who's outside of the tech or venture capital space, that doesn't really make any sense. You don't really consider that Uber doesn't actually make a profit. If you look at a company like Peloton, it just started making a profit because of sort of the pandemic, but these are places that are sort of funded that way. So can you speak to that ecosystem and sort of the logic behind that idea?
Yeah, well, part of the idea that drives the venture capital world is you're trying to hit home runs constantly. And so if you invest in 10 companies and 9 of them burn up all the cash you invest and kind of flame out, but one of them becomes this giant globe-spanning company, then that's a win for you. And so there is this impulse to sort of push these companies to try to become these really large organizations rather than trying to just kind of, you know, be a small, nicely profitable company. So I think in some ways, just sort of the venture capital model and the incentives that are there is one way that companies like WeWork are in some ways already interested in trying to grow as quickly as they can, but they become that becomes the driving impulse, because the people who are funding them only really are interested in trying to create these giant companies.
And that's the key thing, because my co-host Sagar, who couldn't make it today, he's reading the book as well. His immediate question was, why can't WeWork just be a big company, right? Like $3 billion WeWork, which it is now, to your sort of normal person, that seems huge. But to your point here, if you're a venture capital fund, like for, you know, that actually isn't a great return. That actually isn't, or at least given at the valuations people were investing in, that wouldn't actually be a successful exit there. So that's the sort of important thing to note.
Yeah, and there was this key moment in the WeWork story, which is the entry of SoftBank, and that happened in 2017, and leading up to that point, WeWork had raised a large amount of money, more than $1 billion, but it was running out of places to go for cash, and there was actually an impulse at that moment to kind of say, you know, we might need to go public now. Maybe we're only a $15 billion company. That might even be a little bit of a stretch. But let's try to see if we can kind of flip the switch at that point, as all these companies say they're going to do, flip the switch from we're growing to we're going to figure out how to sort of normalize our operations. And then what happened is SoftBank came in and said, here's $4 billion. We want you to keep growing as fast as you can. And that moment was again, one that has continued to repeat from SoftBank specifically and the Vision Fund, which we can talk about in various industries of these companies that just kind of are getting supercharged. And even if there might be some impulse within the company to kind of find a nice even way to operate, it's hard to turn down $4 billion and go and pursue the growth that someone's pushing you towards.
Yeah. So before we get into SoftBank, I think the question here would be, what's driving the lack of profitabilities of these sort of companies, right? Because when I'm saying companies, I'm not just referring obviously to WeWork. You're also thinking of the Ubers, the Lyfts, the Pelotons. Why is it that these companies aren't, so when they're choosing to pursue growth, what are they sacrificing from a profitability perspective?
There's a version of WeWork's business that could be profitable. And in fact, in its very early days, it was. And the issue is that to operate WeWork's business in a profitable way, you have to do so pretty slowly. Unlike a lot of startups, WeWork was bringing in a lot of revenue early on, because every month their members, their tenants were paying them rent. And so, you know, when there's a version of this where that could have continued and the company could have grown kind of slowly, but somewhat methodically, and instead kind of what was sort of that is basically what was sacrificed. And instead you take this money, that you're given from investors and you basically subsidize the service. You subsidize, you know, WeWork was offering, a year, even 2 years of free rent to people in order to get them in the building and on this idea that in the long term, they're going to love the product and they want to stay. And that's the same thing that's kind of happened with Uber, with all of the food delivery companies is, you know, none of us are currently paying what these services actually cost. And so it's all in an effort to basically try to make yourself just so ingrained in the industry that whatever industry you're in, whether it's taxi service or commercial real estate, that eventually people will pay what it costs. So that of course is the question that remains to be seen for all of these companies. And I don't totally know if there are many that have really figured it out yet.
Yeah. So can we talk a bit about Amazon, especially sort of towards its inception and for its sort of middle bit? Because if you sort of, it's easy for us to sit here and especially for listeners to sort of look sarcastically at this sort of model. But in many ways, if you're a 2010 startup, you're looking at what Amazon did, which is for the first, you know, what, 6, 7, 8, 10 years, Amazon was not a profitable company. It was a sort of a money pit. You know, you could sort of go back and look at some 2001 Motley Fool article about how it's never going to make a profit. Now Amazon's huge. So I feel like if you're any sort of tech founder or venture capitalist, to your point about home runs, you're searching for the next Amazon. If you have to lose some money to get there, that seems to make sense.
Yeah. I guess the question is, are you building an Amazon-like company or not? You know, part of the problem for something like WeWork was that they didn't really get cheaper for the company the bigger it got and the different ways that it expanded, because it's a real estate company. It had to continue sort of adding real estate, which was expensive. Amazon had plenty of expenses, obviously, but it sort of was in this kind of more methodical way, expanding sort of what it was offering, you know, in a way where when you move from selling books to selling everything else, it kind of makes sense. But and you can see how eventually you're going to achieve these kind of economies of scale that sort of help you out. With WeWork, every new space more or less cost as much as the last one that you added, and they were able to kind of trim those costs a little bit, but in doing something that was so physically intensive, they just couldn't quite shave them off in the way that Amazon was able to through its business model. So I think that's one thing, but you know, the flip side of that is, of course, yeah, everyone wants that. And everyone doubts these things before they happen. So that's one of the reasons that founders keep shooting for that kind of goal to attain.
And this is the key thing though, which is that you said WeWork was a real estate company.
Yeah.
Amazon is a tech company. The thing is though, and this then leads into SoftBank, WeWork, Adam Neumann, et cetera, argue that they were a tech company. You're sort of arguing that this isn't the traditional real estate business. It's only worth $3 billion. It's a tech company. So can you sort of, before we sort of get into what was quote unquote techie about WeWork, what is your definition of a tech company? Because this also leads into the Vice conversation with its inflated valuation. But what is a tech company?
That's a good question. I don't know if I've ever thought about it until this moment, so bear with me. But I guess it would seem to be something where we're building and managing software is at the heart of what you do. And I think with something like WeWork, that just wasn't the case. The heart of what WeWork did was building and operating physical spaces. And what the company sort of was trying to do was to use technology and to develop technology that made that easier. But for one thing, it never quite did that. It was never quite able to create, any of the various things that it hoped to, including, some version of kind of an internal LinkedIn. I think you have to look at what is actually core to what your business does. And I think you, with WeWork, it became pretty clear that this was a real estate company. I think it's a more interesting kind of dilemma to look at something like an Uber or a Lyft. The core of those businesses is people providing, driving a car for someone. Those companies have sort of been very pointed in claiming we don't own the car, we don't operate the car. That's of course a big debate going on right now. So I think those are sort of more edge cases in at least thinking about what a tech company is.
Definitely. And could you sort of speak to the attempts that WeWork made to sort of define itself as a tech company, aside from just sort of I actually worked in two different WeWorks, and I remember that sort of social network function. It seemed weird to me. Not weird. It just seemed like another. Yeah. If you told me in 2017 that was sort of part of the pitch, I'd be like, that seems, it seems fine. It's fine that you could use this sort of thing. But could you speak sort of, I think the examples you wrote about are, what was it, the temperature levels?
Yeah. there were kind of all those kinds of things, which were, some of this now feels quaint, but, a standing desk that automatically adjusts to your height, a phone booth that adjusts to the temperature you want automatically. All these things are potentially ways in which you could make an office more techie, I guess, but they weren't weren't things that would actually change the basic economics of the business. They would make the offices maybe a little nicer, but wouldn't sort of make that much of a difference in the business. What Adam kept talking about was that WeWork was going to be a physical social network, was sort of the talking point that he actually landed on pretty early on. Way back in 2012, he sort of started talking about that. And even before that, he had kind of been talking about it a little bit internally. And the idea was, we have all these buildings, we're going to connect you to all of the people who are in the other WeWork. So you're not just running into your neighbor at the coffee station in your own WeWork, but you can connect with any of them around the world. And they tried that, as it sounds like, you saw some version of this. There were many different versions of trying to create that network, but LinkedIn already exists, and it wasn't sort of, Facebook already exists. These other social networks kind of already existed, and it just never became clear what the sort of use of this would be. And I think that's at least some kind of lesson is that you can't just sort of slap technology onto what you're doing already and expect it to kind of make a difference and to suddenly turn you into a tech company.
Yeah, my favorite random anecdote from the book was that the Magnesis then Fire Festival, Billy McFarland of recent podcast fame, actually was sort of in talks to get bought by WeWork, because Magnesis was the company that was sort of trying to build that live sort of in-person community aspect. So that was so random, but it actually does make sense from a narrative perspective, at least.
Yeah, I mean, Billy was, he was a tenant for a long time at WeWork, well before the Fire Festival. And when I talked to him in prison, he sort of was inspired, claimed to have been kind of inspired by WeWork and the desire to sort of connect people. Obviously, both of these efforts sort of went off the rails a little bit, but it does make sense. It at least makes sense in the way of, like, WeWork was trying to find all of these different ways to build community. And I think the trouble is, as the WeWork story points out, is it's difficult to do that. It's difficult to do that in the real world, and no one has quite figured it out.
Do you think people are so, and this is why I sort of titled this section of the script "Stories Matter." So I think if Adam had a key skill set, it was being able to sort of tell stories in that post-recession, you know, software is eating the world, and the community part was huge. Do you think people are searching for community in the way that he was articulating it?
I think they were. I mean, definitely after the recession, you know, you look at a lot of the rhetoric that WeWork was using. It was a lot of the rhetoric of kind of what we now sort of assume that millennials, especially younger workers, were looking for in their offices. And I, you know, we're in a different era now, but I think obviously community is something we're all kind of desperate for and figuring out how to get in sort of new ways. But I do think that Adam kind of tapped into that. And I don't, you know, a lot of people have asked me and I talked to a lot of people who were close to Adam about this, of whether he sort of believed that pitch or if it was just kind of a sales pitch. And I think he did. I think he genuinely believed that people wanted community, they wanted connection. And I think he was right about that. And I think where things got tricky is that, as a few people pointed out to me, community is a difficult thing to scale. And every social network has discovered this in different ways. And the challenges are even more so when you're talking about a physical, you know, a physical community of actual people in an actual space.
Yeah. So something that fascinates me is throughout the book, you quote Adam as sort of referring to his ideal end state of WeWork as being a company that's sort of too big to fail, which is sort of another example of how sort of post-2008 financial crisis rhetoric sort of. So A, that brings up the obvious question of, let's say the WeWork bonanza had sort of gone on into sort of COVID disaster space. Yeah. Do you think there ever was a world where that could have been possible? Is too big to fail an idea that even applies to real estate? Because, you know, I think you're in New York, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
So I think anyone who lives in New York or any big city like San Francisco is thinking about this a lot.
Yeah. I'm looking at a lot of buildings and all of them are owned by different people. No one dominates the real estate world. And it's obviously, you know, there's a certain amount of irony in the idea of too big to fail becoming something that people aspire to, when in fact it was sort of a moniker of these institutions that had failed society, really. And not something that we wanted, a sort of a necessary evil, I guess. If you look at the real estate world in general, yeah, I think it's no one aspires to be too big to fail. It's almost impossible. If you look anywhere in New York City and San Francisco, or really all over the world, owning a few percentage points is the most anyone could hope for. And that's not 2-4%. That's 0.1, 0.2, 0.3% of the market is really, those are some of the biggest real estate companies around. So there was this level at which that idea didn't totally make sense. It was an ambition that was probably too ambitious for its own good.
Yeah. So back to the SoftBank part where we sort of left off at in the narrative. And this is why we were talking about what is a tech company. Because obviously SoftBank is, you know, is Japanese. Masayoshi Son is investing in tech companies. Can you sort of speak to how that conversation started and why that investment sort of mattered for the company in 2016, 2017?
They first met, Adam and Masa met in 2016 in India at a startup conference. And it wasn't until sort of the end of 2017 that the investment actually came through, but it was over sort of a course of a year and a half of discussion. And yeah, you know, SoftBank is this sort of technology conglomerate. And the big thing that had happened in advance of the WeWork investment was the creation of the Vision Fund, which was this $100 million venture capital fund, largely backed by the Saudi Arabian government, among other investors, that had entrusted Masa with sort of trying to find companies that were building sort of the future. You know, he had talked about it kind of in the way that Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's firm sort of had collected kind of companies in various industries that had defined the economy of the last century. He wanted to look forward. And in large part, that meant artificial intelligence. And that was Moss's great sort of thing that he zeroed in on. The other thing that Masa loved was he loved entrepreneurs and he loved ambition, and he, you know, very famously made a bet early on Jack Ma and Alibaba that turned into one of the best venture capital investments of all time. And the way Masa has always talked about it is that he invested as much in Jack Ma as he did in the business. And that seems to have been the case with WeWork, where he connected, he saw all the reasons that there was reason to question what WeWork was selling, that it was something more than a real estate company, but he seems to have bought into Adam's ability to sort of push that vision and push the company towards that.
Yeah. So the sort of famous anecdote that comes out of Masa's interactions with Adam was his whole, I think, and correct me if the quote is wrong, who wins in a fight, a crazy man or a smart man? Adam picks crazy man. I'm curious what you sort of think as someone who's involved in that story of like looking at that sort of quote 5 years later. It's unclear what the answer is from sort of Masa's perspective, because I think the problem here is that from a venture capital perspective, the crazy man, if that's one out of 100, that seems to make sense. But I'm just, how do you think about that quote 5 years later?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, because I don't know if he's wrong.
Yeah, that's the.
I think in many ways that probably is the reality. On the other hand, you'd like to think that smarts and tactics and strategy can win the day. And you know, as with all of these kind of dichotomies, the answer is probably in the middle. Like you want to have a plan, you want to be smart, and then if you want to build one of these giant behemoths, you're going to at some point have to do something that traditional business sense MBA school education would tell you to do otherwise. And that is kind of, I think that's maybe some of the lesson here is, and it's, you know, all of this gets simplified where there were plenty of people and we were working on plans and models and all of these things. And I think the issue was that at a certain point, more often than not, those were thrown out the window and the ambition was just, yeah, this may not totally make sense, but we got the money to do it. We're going to give it a shot. And the impulse, the right impulse may be to stick with your plan more often than not, and to be crazy when the moment feels right.
Yeah. So before we move out of sort of this space, I made reference to the whole software is eating the world idea, because that's sort of another one of these stories that matters. So Mark Andreessen of A16Z, co-founder of Netscape, has this essay that he sort of puts in the Wall Street Journal that basically are, and obviously he did not create the sort of boom of these companies in of himself, but I think he summed up the idea that defined the tech and VC space in the 2010s, which is that just as Netflix took over Blockbuster, just as Uber beat the taxi unions and the regulators, you're going to see anything that's involved in software and tech just radically transform industries. And that, when you apply that framework to the venture capital idea, that suggests you should be taking your billions and putting it into search for those home runs in the space. So as we're closing out, well, the 2010s have been closed out. Can you just sort of look back at that narrative and sort of just think about how it sort of applied, especially given that a lot of companies in those industries haven't actually turned the profits or had the successful IPOs or even the exits that narrative would suggest?
Yeah, I think, as I think about this question, there was an interesting article last year in The Atlantic by Derek Thompson that was sort of about about the fact that if you look at all these tech companies and their effect on sort of the physical environment that we live in, the effect isn't that much. And in a lot of ways, the tech world has chosen to kind of, you know, focus on information knowledge-based kind of endeavors as opposed to remaking the physical world. And WeWork, for better or worse, was an effort to kind of try to do that. And I think the lesson of some of these companies is that it's actually really hard to do this. And that, you know, disruption is not as easy as it seems when you're dealing with the physical world with real people as opposed to just sort of real people interacting in the digital space.
Yeah, and then to bring it sort of back to Mark Andreessen for a second. He did another essay in May called It's Time to Build, talking about, it's not a repudiation of software is eating the world, but it basically just sort of, it's like a, I'd say it's an addendum that COVID and sort of the various post 2016 issues have related the need to sort of build in the physical space as well too. Are you confident in this model of investments of the tech industry and this model of investments ability to build sort of in the world of, you know, atoms, not just in bits?
I'm a little skeptical because, and in some ways, you know, the venture capital world may not want to be involved there. You know, you don't want to fund these businesses that are incredibly labor intensive and capital intensive. That's sort of the, you know, the opposite of what many of these venture capital firms are pushing companies toward. And so, you know, it's possible that for a lot of these problems, the VC world is not the place that's going to solve them, that it's going to take, you know, bigger institutions. And I think, you know, I remember that essay by Mark Andreessen, and I remember reading it and kind of thinking, you know, he objected in many ways to the notion that the government should be responsible for a lot of these things. But I think the reality is with all of these industries, you need a big institution to be driving any kind of real change, and that disrupting these things is actually very difficult, and that venture funded startups may not be the best way to do it. So I do think it's a time to build. I think that new kind of empires and new ways of doing things are going to be built. And sort of, I think the question is what the VC world has learned from kind of the past decade of doing things this way.
Yeah. So speaking of the decade, the part that works from a narrative perspective is how tidy this, and obviously recessions are terrible, but WeWork starts post-recession. We're in this weird COVID recession where no one is going to the office at all. How do you think about, and I'm guessing, I think you're recording from home as am I right now.
Yep.
How do you think about, so two questions here. Question one is, what narratives do you think are going to come out of this COVID recession space? And then two, how do you think work is going to change? I personally am not in the category of person who thinks that we're all going to enjoy working from home. I've been doing this for 6 months. It's awful. I can't wait to, I used to go to New York a lot. I'm in DC right now. I can't wait to get back. I don't think cities are over, but how do you think about those two things, the narratives and sort of the future of work discussion?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the narrative is hard to figure out, I think, especially because it feels like we're in the middle of it. It doesn't feel like we're coming out of it yet. And I think, you know, the narrative will be that, you know, I think everything we do going forward is going to be with being prepared for this happening again, I think, is something that we're all going to have to deal with. And then with office space, I mean, yeah, the sort of irony of the WeWork story is that what the company offered is kind of what we all sort of desperately want right now. Like, I would love to be in an office space where I could, you know, go meet people, you know, every single day, just buy the coffee. And so, you know, what will the future look like? I don't think we're all going to be working from home. I think there's a strong possibility that sort of the model that we work had instituted of these kind of flexible spaces. You know, you might not need a big headquarters. You might need just a couple of small offices here and there. I think finding sort of unique ways to use space is going to be important, which in some ways, if WeWork can sort of weather the storm, puts them in a reasonable position to kind of try to figure this out. On the other hand, all of the other commercial real estate giants in the world are trying to answer the same questions and you know, in some ways maybe as equally suited to figuring it out. So it's going to be kind of a race to sort of both figure out what people want out of their offices, because, you know, I don't know that we're going to go back to exactly what was normal. But, you know, will a company really be able, you know, there's all these tech companies that are saying, you know, remote work for good. I don't know if that's going to happen, and the whatever the sort of in between is, I think is going to be what most companies gravitate towards.
Yeah. So to tee up a narrative for you then that I see emerging from certain parts of VC Twitter would be the sort of decentralization case that what's going to happen after this, and this is really coming from a lot of people who are in the sort of cryptocurrency Bitcoin community, that centralization is a set, not, I don't want to sort of parody of you, but basically what I would say in good faith is that decentralization is going to be the story of the 2020s, away from sort of big companies that have these big fancy headquarters, away from sort of big cities with hour and a half commutes. It's going to be much more about companies that could get even further online, so they have a remote distributed workforce. That's sort of, and so what do you think about that? And I personally, I like what you're saying about that there's an, that we shouldn't have a binary choice here, but there's an in-between. What I would say is I would lean more towards centralization in the sense that a company that does say, look, obviously we're flexible 4 or 5 days a week, we could like work something out, but we are located in Austin, we are located in DC, we are located in New York. That is going to be a company that goes way too far into the remote idea where they're sort of like, we've got Indians and Nigerians, then there's this dude in Alaska and it's so great because we can do this sort of techno-libertarian thing. But I'm just sort of skeptical of that model.
Yeah, I think anytime these kind of these real sort of societal disruptions happen, I think there's a skepticism of large institutions in some way. I think you look at the financial crisis, like the places where people wanted to go work, the Lehman Brothers, the Bear Stearnses of the world, where people were suddenly very skeptical of them. You know, small business was sort of the thing that people wanted for a variety of reasons. And then look, by the end of the decade, we're talking about these giant companies with tens of thousands of employees that had grown out of nothing. And so I think there will be a cycle that may emerge where there may be some decentralization in all the kinds of ways that you talk about. But ultimately, I think, you know, the corollary to that is you know, people want to be in cities. People want to work at these big companies in a lot of ways. And so, you know, I could see some change for a while, but I would suspect that it will, in the way that these cycles sort of work, that it will trend back towards where it was.
Yeah. So for our last section, I'm going to do a very inelegant pivot to your reporting on Vice. You're a journalist. And the reason why I think these things are tied together, and I'm curious if this was sort of in your head as you're doing the reporting on both these stories, is that in many ways, the story of Vice News, media company founded in Canada, headquartered in New York, gave us Shane Smith, Gavin McGinnis, there's a lot of stuff like that's a whole other episode to a certain degree. But I am just sort of curious at a structural level, within the level we're having this conversation, sort of the ideas of taking a lot of venture capital, the idea that industries that are typically sort of outside of tech, aka journalism in this case, when you sort of add sort of the internet, they could have that sort of big return too. How can you just sort of talk about like a tie between the story of Vice and WeWork?
Yeah, I mean, I thought about these companies very clearly as sort of corollaries to each other, and I'd throw Uber in there as well, which I wrote about in 2017 for New York Magazine. And I think there were two sort of themes I saw in the ways these companies sort of kind of, I think, get away from themselves. And the main one, one is just growing fast is hard. And I think a lot of the problems that emerge in these companies just come from that fact, whether they're sort of business model problems or internal HR issues. A lot of it just comes from when you're suddenly adding dozens and then hundreds and eventually, in WeWork's case, thousands of employees a year. It's hard to keep up with that. And then I think the thing that all these companies sort of tried to do was they weren't, and this goes for, you know, so many companies that I can think of over the past decade of not being sort of content to just do what you're good at and be what you are. I mean, Vice made these great sort of punk-y kind of news documentaries. They were extremely popular and they were really good at it. And but that wasn't enough for what Shane Smith and others wanted. You know, he talked about, as I think you said, being the new CNN, being the new ESPN. He kind of wanted to just be the new giant media company for young people. And And it wasn't, it was never sort of clear that, that Vice was going to become that. And you could sort of argue that, you know, shooting for the stars is a good enough goal to have. But I think a lot of the ways in which these companies sort of go off the rails is tied to how they try to pursue different businesses that they aren't necessarily expert in. And to tie it back to WeWork, it goes for the company getting into apartments and opening a gym and eventually opening an elementary school, all of which were connected by the fact that, you know, you needed a space to put those things in, but otherwise are basically entirely different businesses.
So sort of the earlier part of the conversation, we were basically discussing whether or not real estate was a venture return industry. Mm-hmm. Do you think, and this is where the debate around Vice matters, and this also applies to a variety of other companies, Mike, Mashable, Upworthy that took on venture capital. Do you think journal, and you obviously, you know, you're with New York Magazine, which is owned by Vox Media, which has taken on venture capital as well. Do you think, broadly speaking, however, journalism is an industry where the venture capital return idea applies?
Yeah, well, I hate to be a company man, but I think if you look at kind of the companies that have emerged from the VC model in the journalism space, there aren't a ton of real kind of long-term success stories. And I think one reason Vox has been pretty good at doing that, at least, you know, compared to some of our competitors, is a sense of growing responsibly and making smart bets rather than trying to, you know, claim, you know, we're going to be the replace the New York Times or whatever it might be. So, you know, in theory, any industry is open to that. I mean, you know, one of the problems is I think in these businesses, and this is one problem I think the venture world runs up against, is there's always an impulse of like, you know, let's solve this with technology. And journalism is not something you can solve with technology. Technology can help, but ultimately there need to be people there to make these judgment calls, to do the reporting, to do the writing. And, you know, ultimately they're kind of labor intensive businesses. So they're never going to totally return the, you know, 20x kind of multiples that other places are getting. But, you know, I think if you handle it kind of responsibly and sensibly, and that's the approach you take, then there is some promise in these industries.
Great. Well, that's an optimistic tone, which is good to have after the first
trying
part of this
to
conversation.
Have, trying to may hold on to any kind of optimism I can.
Definitely. So Reeves, thank you so much. Where can everyone find you?
You can search my name and you'll find me on Twitter and various other places. And the book is of course available wherever you like to buy books. So
great. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. We'll be back next week with our regularly scheduled programming before the election. Talk to you then.